Hey everybody, it's your friends, Brad and Dave.
And we're just dropping into your feed to tell you about a special offer this month.
Here's the special offer. Join us on Patreon at the $5 level and you'll get
an exclusive episode of Drunk Comic Lab.
It's a Patreon-only hour of us talking comics while suitably soused.
Oh, you will regret missing this. Brad is a delight.
And when you join, you'll also get an ebook of how to make web comics.
That's right. This is our how-to book on web cartooning that's now gone through 4 successful printings at Image Comics.
And when you join us on Patreon, you'll also get an ebook of the Webcomics Handbook.
So now that's 2 ebooks you're getting. This one with over 200 pages of actionable advice and how-tos that you can apply to your cartooning today.
So that's the scoop. Join us before Thanksgiving,
November 28th.
And get 2 free ebooks plus the exclusive episode of Drunk Comic Lab.
Gang, you already know you love the show, and here is your chance to join us on Patreon and get 3 cool freebies.
And if you're already at the $5 level or higher, all you gotta do is stick around. You'll get your reward on the 29th.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics. All right, Brad Geiger, so I'm living in London. I'm like 19 years old, and a friend of mine comes home from, I don't know if it was from the pub or whatever, and he throws his bag down on the floor, and he goes, "We're going to Ireland." And I said, "What?" He goes, "We're going to go biking around Ireland."
Okay.
And I go, "All right, we're going to go biking around Ireland." So we grab a train over to Wales. We get on a boat. We ferry over to Dublin. We take a train down to the Ring of Kerry, and we're going to bike around the Ring of Kerry in southwestern Ireland, Brad, right? And it's delightful.
Okay.
The first day, my legs are screaming. I'm painfully out of shape, even at 19. And the second day, I'm biking 10, 20 miles. Third day, 10, 20 miles. But the part I wanted to tell you about, Brad, is on day 3, we're, I don't know where we were, probably like Waterville, we pull over as though it's a lot. It's just farms. We pull over into this grass field and we lay our bikes down and we start to have our lunch, right? There's no fence. There's nothing to indicate that it's like, this is my private property, right? That kind of thing.
Yes.
It's just more grass in a country that is 99.9% grass.
Right.
So, we pull over, we start having our sandwiches, and all of a sudden, this guy, stereotypical looking Irish farmer, literally holding a pitchfork, Brad, comes out of his barn.
Geez.
Literally holding a pitchfork, comes out and goes, "Right, right, you boys, what are you doing? What are you doing on my land there? Right, you boys, what are you doing?" And I'm like, "Oh God, oh God." So I, as you do, if you're trained at all to be polite, I popped right up, standing upright. I'm like, "Sir, I'm so sorry. We'll move along. I'm so sorry. We didn't mean to eat on your property. We were just..." "Right, what are you doing? If you're going to eat on my land, then you're going to come up to the farmhouse and have lunch with the wife and I. That's what you're going to do." So Greg and I leave our bikes by the road. He's like, "Oh, no one's going to steal it. Who's going to steal it? My sheep, leave your bikes there." And so we walk up the hill, go into the farmhouse. His wife makes tea, a delicious little sandwich is set. We talk about what his life is like. We talk about what our life is like.
Oh,
but the
my
fact
God.
That, like, in my American mind, this guy's coming at me with a pitchfork. And I'm like, "All right, I guess I could use the bike to defend myself." And in the meantime, he's like, "Right, you're not eating by the side of the road. Come up to the house and have a proper set of tea and biscuits, and you're going to talk to the wife and I."
Oh,
and
my
Greg and I were dying laughing that night, going to sleep, just thinking, like, we thought we were dead. And in the meantime, the guy's like, "No, here, look, I've got some delightful crackers for you. You're going to love them."
What are you doing eating on the ground? We've got a table right inside the house.
Right. "Grab your man there, and we're going up to the farmhouse. Right, come on."
Oh, that story makes my heart happy. That's actually the nicest cold open we've had in a long time.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, at some point, I've told you about my dream trip, haven't I?
No.
My dream trip is to grab some of my favorite people in the world, you among them, and go to take a week on one of the long boats down the River Cam in England, not in Ireland, in England.
Mm-hmm.
They have the old canals that the Victorians and some of the pre-Victorians built. And they kind of went fallow, but you can still rent longboats that are basically like RVs, and you travel up and down the lock system of the canal from like Cambridge down to London or London up to Cambridge. And it's a motorized boat that's like 30 feet long, and you barbecue and you drink beers on the top of the boat and you go down the locks and stuff like that. And so I want to get out to British Isles countryside with you in a bad way somewhere in the years ahead. That's my dream vacation.
Yeah. No, that sounds fantastic.
And I don't know if we'll have farmers chasing us in pitchforks telling us to come have a delightful lunch, but but regardless.
It all depends on which way Brexit goes.
Well, on that optimistic note, I want to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. Right, I'm Brad Geiger, editor of editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, non-judgmental cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon, and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave, let's talk comics, but let's talk comics with somebody.
Oh, Brad, with one of my favorite people in the world, one of my favorite caricaturists in the world. Oh, I said it right. Ha! Sorry, before the show, I've been saying caricature wrong, and Brad lovingly said, you keep saying character, and I'm like, no, yeah. All right. And Brad, as luck would have it, my little red light is blinking, So let's switch over and welcome our guest onto the show. All right, well, Brad, we have one of our favorite people in the world on the show with us, one of my favorite characters in the world, and an amazing artist, amazing human being. I love him tremendously. Tom Richmond out of Minneapolis. Tom, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm great, Dave. Brad, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, Tom, you know best world from Mad Magazine. Tom's been working for years doing amazing work there. You also know him from books like The Mad Art of Caricature, Goodnight Batcave, Don't Let the Penguin Drive the Batmobile. And I got to tell you, Tom, I think I've told you this in person. Goodnight Batcave is a family favorite in the Kellett household. So I am super thankful that you did that book. That one is delightful, and we love it tremendously. So thank you for that.
Oh, thanks for reading it. I actually get that quite a bit. A lot of people really dig that one. It was a lot of fun to do.
It's a really fun mashup of Goodnight Moon and the Batman themes of Long Stan and DC. So Tom is one of my, as I said, one of my favorite caricaturists and artists in the world. And you've worked for clients literally all over the world, everybody from Fortune 500 to the bigger magazine clients. And we wanted to have you on because I think, Brad, this is fair to say that you and I are potentially two of the worst caricaturists in the world, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
In contrast?
If you ran a contest for the worst, you and I would be right neck and neck.
Yeah, I feel like if it was a sci-fi show where Tom was being the anti-Tom was being cloned, it would be Brad and Dave walking out of that machine. So I want to. Can we start at the beginning, Tom? So how did you got your start? If I remember correctly, in theme parks, right when you were very young.
Yeah. Well, that's where I found my love for caricature. Certainly. I was going to college for art, but I had really no direction, and I got a job doing caricatures in between summers, you know, or between school seasons, and fell in love with the art form.
Yeah, it's an amazing to see over the years your especially I've been lucky enough to see some of your early stuff, but one of the things Brad and I were talking about before the show was that theme park style, that very specific standard conventions of caricaturing at theme parks. How did that get locked in, do you think, where it's the sort of three-quarter head, the two heads high figure, everybody's on a surfboard and holding a tennis racket.
roller skating, don't forget that one.
Roller skating, also a popular one. Yeah, but like, what is it about that aspect of caricature that's sort of locked in? Like, you can go to Six Flags in Ohio, you can go to Disney World in Florida, you can go somewhere in Canada, and it's that almost identical caricature, which for a lot of people, they get to that and then they stop. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of doing a disservice to those types of artists to say that they're all the same, actually.
Uh-huh.
That's true.
There's a lot of very different types of live caricature going on. I was part of a documentary that's going to come out sometime, hopefully in the next year or so, called American Caricature, that kind of follows that art form, the live caricature art form, around. But you're right. I mean, there's a certain look that a lot of these parks have, and it's mainly a function of convenience and speed and
yeah.
the fact that you're supposed to get these things done in 5 minutes, you know, or less. And some people take the easy road, you know, kind of sort of doing the same relationships of features on everybody, kind of similar head shapes and similar shapes for the different features. And there's a what we call a cookie cutter caricature, a generic caricature that has very little variation. They're just really fast, and they rely more on the showmanship, you know, mm-hmm. the kind of performance aspect of it than they do the actual art, you know. But
right.
there are some live caricature artists out there that are mind-boggling. I mean, you watch them work, and you're just like, how do they do that in just a few minutes?
Yeah.
And they're different from all the other ones that they do. So it's like anything else, you know. There are people that excel and people that just sort of do it. I always get mine done wherever I go. I've got a huge pile. Oh yeah. I've got like 400 caricatures of me.
Oh really?
Oh yeah.
Well now I know from, I think either a past conversation with you or a past conversation with Danielle Corsetto that mm-hmm. you, have frequented the, I don't remember the name of it, but the caricature convention in Northern America somewhere. Brad's yeah. making fun of me because I keep mispronouncing caricature. Sorry about that. tell me a little bit about that convention. How did it get started? What goes on? Cause I know everybody, one of the basic tenets is that everybody caricatures everyone there, right?
Yeah, I think, and if I'm not mistaken, this might be the 20th anniversary of that this year.
Wow.
Well, it started out very small. It was called the National Caricaturists Network, and it was just about 15 artists that got together in Cancun in like 99, I think. So that would be 20 years. And everybody drew each other, and at the end of the weekend, they put them up on the wall, and they voted on best color and best black and white and best overall and that sort of thing. And over the years, it's grown, and it's now called the International Society of Caricature Artists. And there's probably, I guess I don't know how many members there are, but when they do this annual convention, it's now 5 days, and they get 200 or 250 artists.
Wow.
And some of them come from, I mean, there's a contingent that comes from Japan every year, like 12 artists that are Japanese, and people from Europe and all over the country, and they draw each other silly for 4 days. And it's really quite amazing. I mean, you go into this huge hall, you know, or banquet room, like one of those gigantic type rooms, like we have the Rubens in, for example.
Right.
And by the end of the weekend, the walls on that room are covered with art. And it is, you just walk around and you recognize people, of course. Oh yeah, there's yeah. Bob. There's always one or two people that are the favorites, you know, that everybody
right
has
somebody
to draw.
With the big beard or the hook
right.
nose. Yeah
But it's a very fun and extremely humbling experience, because you go there and there are artists there that blow you away, and people that just do pieces that you're just like, you just stare at it for a while and go, I have no idea how they pulled that off. It's amazing. And it is, it's really something. If anybody is a caricature artist, I always recommend them to try to make it to one of those once. It's quite an experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, in some ways it was unfair of me to jump in with the theme park question, because it's more interesting, I think, to talk about like what really is one of the best, I honestly believe this, one of the best caricatures in the world. What is your philosophy of caricature? Like, how do you approach such a unique art form like that? Is there a way to looking at it that maybe I, as someone who's not great at it, could take to heart and maybe learn from?
Well, I always tell people that there are sort of two aspects to how to exaggerate somebody. There's the physical features, and then there's what I call their presence. And I think really good caricature artists are as good at exaggerating somebody's presence as they are their nose, you know? Mm. Like, your features don't really change, but your expression changes, and that's what in a lot of ways, that's what makes you unique, you know? Like, everybody's got sort of the same bones and muscles and, you know, features, but the animation behind them is what makes people unique. So I always try to concentrate on capturing or exaggerating a person's presence. Just to give you an example, like a caricature of Mike Myers, I would make very different choices on that one as opposed to a caricature of him as Austin Powers, you know, not just because of the fake teeth, but the character that he's portraying is that, that presence, that personality is what I'm really exaggerating. And I do that all the time, especially with Mad, you know, because when I draw a caricature of somebody for a movie parody, I'm not really drawing Tom Hanks. I'm drawing Tom Hanks playing Sully from, you know, the movie Sully. And so it's different. It really is. I mean, to do a caricature of Katie Couric with a big, you know, frown on her face isn't really her. You know, we identify her with the giant toothy grin. And so, so exaggerating those aspects of somebody is as important as exaggerating how big their, you know, mouth is, or that's all physical.
Right.
But that's what really impresses me about your work, Tom, is that it's tough enough to do a caricature of somebody. But when I look at your work in Mad Magazine, let me go back to this. I was watching a documentary about voiceover actors, and they said it's one thing to do, to be able to do, you know, like Ronald Reagan's voice, but to really be a voiceover actor, you've got to be able to do Ronald Reagan doing a Foghorn Leghorn impersonation, and then you can consider yourself a voiceover actor. And I thought of you when I heard that, because it's one thing to draw Katie Couric smiling, but as your sequential art goes through its narrative, you've got to draw her in several different emotions, and it's still always her, and you always pull it off. You know, it's like you would, it would just be, you know, Katie Couric going through the news, and she's always smiling, even at the sad parts, you know, because I could not pull out anything else. How do you do that?
Yeah, that's kind of the tough part, and that's where I've got to really study the subject, you know. And the hard part about doing it for Mad is that, like you say, I mean, I have to draw the same person over and over again, and that that character is acting, you know. So they're they have different emotions and expressions and different things I'm trying to do that might be part of selling the gag in the panel or whatever it might be, a narrative. And there is no way that I'm going to find a piece of reference to work from every angle and every expression. So I don't even try.
Right.
What I do is I put together a like a little album of pictures of this, my subject at as many angles as I can find. I'd like to get some profiles and three-quarter views and straight on views. And if I'm lucky, I'll get a couple of expressions. And then it's really important to see them in action, you know, like got to watch the movie. And really try to get a sense of their character, and then try to make the two things meet, you know, in the middle. The other thing about doing it for Mad is I really have to rein in my exaggerations a lot, because if I'm turning the head in space, you know, it's almost like designing an animated character that has to work from all angles. Right. You can't have a giant chin in one panel and then, you know, a giant nose in the next panel. It doesn't work.
Right.
So I have to keep things consistent there. So that's sort of a different animal doing it for Mad and in a narrative type like that. If you've got the freedom to just do a single image, you can have a lot more leeway that way, I think.
Yeah.
Right. And sort of cheat the edges in a way when it's just doing one image.
Yeah, for sure.
So let me ask you, Al Hirschfeld, I always love the story that when someone would hire him to do a caricature or a presentational poster for a theatrical production, he would insist on going through the run-throughs and sitting in the dark and like you said, capturing their energy and their movement and their posture and the way they interacted. And as someone, as an artist who cut their teeth with a lot of, I imagine, probably thousands at that point, live drawings at theme parks and at parties and presentations, do you find when Mad comes to you and says, hey, we need a Tom Hanks, would it be the case that it would be easier for you had you met them and saw them in person and can get a sense of their energy? Or is a movie close enough where you're like, nah, it's workable. I got the sense of how they act in the movie.
Well, most of the time I'm actually doing them as a character. So it's more important to see them in action in the film.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I have very, very occasionally have met people that I have done caricatures of and then met them in person. And that's a very surreal experience, because it's true that, you know, film and whatever TV, that changes what you look like. It really does. I remember this had nothing to do with MAD, but when my very first job in publishing was doing a comic book called Married with Children for a company called Now Comics back in the early 90s. And it was the Fox TV show, right? With Ed O'Neill. And so I did that. I did probably for 4 years, I did like 20 some odd issues of that book. And I drew Ed O'Neill over and over and over again. Got to meet him years later at the Minnesota State Fair. He was promoting the syndication of the show. And I just I made a fool out of myself. I mean, I just stood there and stared at his face. And he kept kind of looking at me, you know, like out of the corner of his eye. And he was talking to other people and he kept looking at me. And I couldn't stop staring at him. I was like, okay, that's not what I expected. It just was so different.
That's actually a twist on the question that you probably get asked all the time, which is, how do you deal with people who say, that caricature doesn't look anything like me? That what you're experiencing is that, but on the other side of the coin.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of people have very unrealistic expectations of what they actually look like.
That's a very generous way of saying that, Tom.
Yeah. I kind of liken it to the Matrix. I say you have your Matrix version of you in your head and not the real world version of you.
That's a funny way to describe it, the Matrix version of me. Well, let me ask you, how do you navigate it when someone, because I'm sure out of hundreds of and thousands of caricatures at theme parks and other locations, person to person, how do you navigate it when someone hates their caricature?
Well, it's like this, you know, you have to take into account where you are and what, you know, what the venue is you're doing this in.
Right.
Like last time I checked, nobody's won a Pulitzer for their caricature work at theme parks. So, if somebody hates their drawing, I just say, well, you know, you don't have to pay for it. Or if they've paid for it, I give them their money back and say, have a nice day. You know, sorry, you didn't like it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I try to explain to them, look, I'm not a particularly mean guy caricature artist anyway. I don't really exaggerate the crap out of people, and I certainly don't look for the most derogatory thing I can do. I try to capture what makes them unique. If they have a big nose, there's not much I can do about that. And if they're sensitive about it, you know, you may get that. But the thing is, I tell, you know, other new artists when they ask me that same question, I say, look, if somebody hates your caricature that you just got done doing, say, boy, I'm really sorry you don't like the caricature. Here's your money back. Have a nice day. And then if somebody thinks your caricature is the greatest thing they've ever seen and you're the next coming of Rembrandt, say, well, I'm really glad you like your caricature. Have a nice day. Because basically that opinion is sort of the same, you know.
Yeah.
These people really don't know what they're looking at. And it's the people who, like your peers, your other artists, if they tell you, wow, that one was really good, you really nailed that guy, then you say, okay, thank you.
Yeah.
That one I'm going to take to heart. So you're in a commercial setting and you just have to divorce yourself from the emotion of, you know,
right.
What you do.
Yeah, I've always, every now and again, I'll see a caricature where it is so dead on that I can hear the person's voice. And it's like, that's my guide. It's like when I hear their voice through that face, then I know that person really nailed it.
That's presence. That's presence.
Yeah,
that's capturing.
That's exactly what you're talking about when you say presence, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I know, I'm sure you guys have seen plenty of, impersonators, comedians that do impressions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes when they do the impressions, they make a face that they actually look like the person.
Yep.
You know, it's like, oh my God, he actually looks like Jack Nicholson right now. But he's like, they're channeling everything, the presence, the expression, all of it. That's how they do it so well.
Yeah. Everybody that does that, Robert De Niro squints their eyes and pulls their lips over their teeth, right? Everybody does the same Robert De Niro because they're channeling that same guy. So now my question is, I know you mentor a lot of young caricaturists and you kind of offer guidance. Where do you see most young caricaturists going wrong? In other words, what's the most, the thing that pops up the most when you see somebody attempting this and they take a wrong turn?
Almost always the problem is that they're trying to run before they can walk. They try to take shortcuts and they say, oh, I'm really exaggerating this face, but they're not capable of like a portrait or putting a face together that's convincing without a lot of exaggeration. And they're leaning on the exaggeration to say, oh, I know these eyes don't line up at all and these cheekbones are 3 inches off, you know, mm-hmm. but it's a caricature. That's not exaggeration. That's just bad drawing. So you really need to be able to have a good handle on drawing the face and the structure of it and being able to make it look convincing no matter what level of exaggeration you apply. And sometimes they just want to go straight to, you know, 100 miles an hour. And it's I try to explain to them, look, you really should work on your, you know, basic drawing skills and your ability to draw convincing features before you start giving somebody a nose the size of a watermelon, you know.
That's funny. Right. That's kind of like how a lot of modern art students are like, well, I'm doing Picasso. It's like, yeah, well, Picasso in the early part of his career knew how to paint a face. Like the reason why he could do the latter stage Picasso was he knew how to do the early stage Picasso.
Well, it's kind of sort of that. I mean, it's really having a good groundwork and it only helps your abilities later on. You know, when the art school I went to had zero cartooning classes, nothing. Mm-hmm. In fact, they frowned on cartooning there. If I tried to do cartooning for an assignment, I got yelled at. Mm-hmm. So I was forced to do realistic drawing and realistic painting and all that stuff. And I'm glad because at the other end of my, you know, college career, I was capable of all that stuff. And then when I went into cartooning, I had those skills and I think it only helped me.
Yeah. Well, speaking of students, you offer workshops, as Brad was saying. And for folks that are interested, over at tomrichmond.com, you can look on the tab that says workshops. And Tom has actually offered one in the past in LA, and I was dying to go, and I couldn't do it for scheduling reasons. But can I ask you, Tom, like, how do you approach teaching? Brad and I were talking about this. How do you approach teaching caricature to someone who has never done it before? Are there some basic steps that you could take us through, even over a podcast, that might explain the first steps for folks?
Yeah, the big thing with approaching a caricature is to start out by what I call deconstructing the face or simplifying it down to its very basic elements. The face seems like a very complicated thing, you know, and it's mainly because we make it complicated. We spend all of our lives communicating by looking at other people's faces. So the subtlest of things makes a big difference to us. But when it all boils down to it, the basic five shapes of the face are just the two eyes, nose, mouth, and head shape. And if you boil it down to those simple shapes, and then you can manipulate the relationships of those shapes, that's where the real power of a caricature happens. So if you can simplify things, it's much easier to play around with their relationships, how big they are compared to one another, how far apart they are, what kind of an angle they are at. And then once you get, you know, those exaggeration choices in place, then you reconstruct the face by adding in all the details and bring it to life. So that's the, you know, being able to see those really simple shapes and the relationships between those shapes is the really tough part. And that's hard to teach people because that's like seeing, you know.
Yeah.
And you can't teach people to see. I mean, I could teach them how to draw an eye and a nose and a mouth. That's technical. But teaching people to look at a face and see that what I see, oh, this person's got a really small forehead and they've got a really wide jaw. If they don't see that, that they've got no place to jump off from, you know, with their drawing.
Right.
So, but I concentrate on these workshops on trying to teach people to see things and notice things in the face. Yeah, we do a lot of technique and I talk a lot about, you know, how to draw a convincing eye and stuff like that is all part of it. But my goal with these workshops is to have somebody leave at the end of the workshop seeing faces differently than they did before they came in. And the big thing I tell people, so I used to teach people at the live theme parks. And at the beginning of the summer, I'd take a new artist and I'd say, you're going to sit down and people are going to walk past you. And maybe one out of every 10 people is going to have a face where you're just going to go, oh my God. Oh, I hope this guy sits down. Look at those eyebrows or something, you know, that just jumps out at you.
And then, Tom, and then, this is my problem when I sit down for a caricature. The caricature is usually going, woo!
Oh, yeah. That just means you're in for a treat.
Yeah.
But then the next nine faces, you look into them and go, oh my God, there's nothing about this face. What, you know, what am I going to do with this person? At the end of the summer, after 3 months of drawing caricatures, maybe three out of every 10 people that walk by, you're going to go, oh, look, I can't wait to draw that person. You know, the thing is, people didn't get funnier looking in the last 3 months. Your eye just got better. You're noticing things you didn't notice before.
Right,
and it's a lifelong pursuit. Like you don't just learn that. You develop your eye and the more you work at it, the more, you know, the less faces give you problems. And it just, it's a continuing journey.
Yeah.
As a side note to that story, Tom, I love the idea that someone's walking by you at a theme park and you're like, sir, you must let me caricature you.
Yeah, I've actually been chased down the New Jersey boardwalk before by these guys. It's a little...
Mr. Geiger, that nose has to be captured.
Yeah. Good luck. Better people than you.
Yeah, it's a curse to be a caricature artist. Sometimes my wife and I have season tickets to like a local theater. We've had for years, and we go to a lot of musicals, and we'll be driving home after the musical's over, and she'll say, what did you think about that number? You know, what did you think about the show in the second half or whatever? And I finally, I fess up and say, I don't remember a thing about that musical. And she said, why not? There was this guy in the chorus that had this huge forehead. And every time he came on stage, I'm looking at it like, look at that guy's forehead. I can't believe he can stand up. He should be just toppling over. It distracts me. And then I can't remember anything about the show.
Well, I got to ask you this. This is one I've always wanted to ask, because Tom, you've been with Mad Magazine how many years? You had a long, long run at Mad.
Yeah, 19.
19 wow. years. So here's something that I it's a personal, something that I've noticed, or I think I've noticed, let's put it that way. It seems to me like that Hollywood from the 50s and 60s was more visually diverse than today. If you look at Hollywood stars from the 50s and 60s, you've got, to name a few, Woody Allen, you've got Jack Lemmon, Jack Nicholson, Walter Matthau, you've got Shirley MacLaine, you've got Sidney Poitier, you've got a lot of different faces. And now today's Hollywood seems very, very homogenized. There's not that much difference between Chris Pratt and a Paul Rudd visually. They're so close. Is it more difficult, or am I just making excuses for not being a good caricaturist?
I think you have a point. In fact, you know who would really agree with you there is Mort Drucker.
Mm-hmm.
Mort used to say that because he did, you know, movie and TV parodies well into the 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
And he would say, there are no more Cary Grants, you know, and he's like, all these faces are like the same model type person. You can't tell between Brad Pitt and Ryan Reynolds and, you know, Ryan Gosling. There's just, I mean, I guess there's a certain standard to that, but yeah, I think you're right. I mean, back in the day, there was just a different sort of, people had more unique looks, and it wasn't just the drop dead handsome, you know, chiseled jaw everybody. But you know, you still have the occasional people that, you know, the Paul Giamatti's and you know, actors like that who's, you know, not they don't play the heartthrob roles and the, you know, the chiseled jaw superheroes.
I imagine Danny DeVito is the gift that keeps giving in today's Hollywood.
Yeah. You know, so there are plenty of great faces out there. That's for sure. I remember when I did the parody of, funny that you mentioned Chris Pratt, but I did Parks and Rec for Mad. And there's some great faces on that show. Boy, you know, everybody's got a really unique, weird look. And it was a lot of fun to draw.
Yeah, that show is delightful. Well, let me ask you this, Tom, before we let you go. So for the 18, 19, 20-year-old out there that wants to become Tom Richman, that looks at you and is like, that's where I want to be in 20 years, what route do you tend to recommend to the young, burgeoning artist / caricaturist / cartoonist that would like to be you when they grow up?
Well, lucky for them, unlike when I was at that point, there's the internet now. So there's an awful lot of resources out there to not only, you know, see people in action and actually doing their craft, but to see work that you wouldn't ordinarily have been exposed to as a kid. You know, when I was a kid, Mad Magazine was it. You mm-hmm. know, where else are you going to see caricatures? I guess TV Guide had them on the covers. But these days, you know, you can just find so much stuff out there. And I usually tell people, look, find a couple of caricature artists that whose work really resonates with you. And it might not even be something that it's not even close to what you do. You know, like Hirschfeld's one of my favorite caricatures, and his stuff couldn't be more different than what I do.
Right.
But that's sort of what fascinates me about it. You know, I look at it and go, how does he do that? You know, I can't do that. My brain doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
But it's inspirational. And I say, find a few caricature artists that inspire you, follow their work, and then, you know, fill up sketchbooks. I mean, there's no secret to it. It's just nothing but seeing and drawing and learning and growing and putting in the work. They hate to hear that.
Well, that's fantastic. Tom, thank you. Thank you for coming by today. Brad and I really appreciate it, as I'm sure all our listeners do. And just a reminder to everybody, you want to go over to tomrichmond.com as his central hub to check out his stuff if you're not yet dove into his beautiful work. You can check out The Mad Art of Caricature, his book that he's done, Goodnight Bat Cave, Don't Let the Penguin Drive the Batmobile, and do check out the workshops that he does all around the country. And Tom, thank you again for coming by today.
Hey, it's been fun. Thank you for having me as a guest. I'm very honored to be here.
Thanks, Tom.
Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute and stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, Brad and I are going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
Yeah, because, you know, when you do, you'll get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And an exclusive Patreon post that go even deeper on the Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, no worries.
You can still support the show by rating us wherever you get podcasts.
Leave us a 5-star review and a few kind words.
And that, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
And now, let's talk comics.
Well, once again, a big reminder that this week's Comic Lab and all the Comic Labs throughout the rest of 2019 are sponsored by the good folks over at Wacom at WACOM.com. And it is, quite honestly, the best possible way we could close out the year because it is the machine that powers our careers.
That's
and
right.
We couldn't find a better partner to do Comic Lab with than Wacom. And Brad, my heart is full. My heart is full with the Wacom sponsorship.
And believe me, to fill that guy's heart, you've got to really do some heavy lifting. So he's got a big heart. So we want to thank.
What kind of an insult is that?
That's
it had all the trappings of an insult, but it was like, I tell you what, that's a guy with a lot of love in his heart. That son of a bitch.
Yeah, what? I was going to say, I meant that as a compliment. He's got a big heart. You know what your problem is? You're so used to me insulting you when I say something nice. you don't know how to take it.
I know. What's funny is like our friendship is built on sarcasm and jibes so that when one of us genuinely goes, no, you know what? I love you like a brother. You're a great person. The other was like, what's the play here? What are you going? You need money? What's happening?
Love me like a brother. I know how you feel about your brother.
So all of that is to say we are super thankful to our sponsor Wacom over at WACOM.com, and we look forward to them sponsored through the rest of the year with us. And Bradley J. Geiger, what's our first question for this week?
This is actually a question that you have come up with. I'm putting your question to the top of the list because I like it so much.
Oh, all right.
It's a topic that you wanted to raise, and what you've got here really intrigues me. It says, what do you do when your imagination exceeds your abilities?
Well, so this came out of a quote that was retweeted by many artists that I follow in my social media stream. Mm-hmm. I think it originated with the creator of Gundam, the Japanese property. And the idea that like most of my career has been a struggle where my imagination was greater than my abilities. And I think the phrase, your imagination is greater than your abilities, really describes Brad's high school dating career, I think, for one thing. Don't you think that that's a good shorthand?
Yeah,
for...
and the sad thing is that it didn't mean I had a big imagination. It just mean I had no abilities.
Oh, poor 16-year-old Brad. Oh man,
I can laugh now.
Oh. So, but anyway, I think this is a problem we can all relate to because, in fact, I had this happen, I'm going to say maybe 3 weeks ago, and it was just a really stark relief of how much this happens to all of us. I was drawing a specific panel for Drive, and it was kind of a splash pagey kind of a panel. Mm-hmm. It was a big reveal in a submarine to what was going to be an underwater mega city, a city that could have 25 million plus people in it, right?
Sounds horrible. And,
oh, right. So there's a lot of there's hydrodynamics going on. There's the way light comes through the water. There's the way the buildings project up and out of water. How does the light come from the windows of the city?
Yeah.
Does water contort the drawing at all? You know, is like there any heat vents that might contort the visuals through water? There's a lot of things that could go on. And basically, in my mind's eye, when I woke up that morning, I had a beautiful image in my mind. And then as I drew it, and it came out fine, but as I started, it was like, this is the drawing. And boy, did my imagination exceed my abilities. And it's kind of rad. We've talked about that quote from, I believe it was This American Life, that the path of an artist is your editorial eye jumps up and then your abilities rise to meet it. And then your editorial eye jumps up again. And mm-hmm. then your abilities rise to meet that new level. And I think at any given time, all of us can imagine greater than we can draw, and maybe even write. So, Brad, let me hear you. Have you ever had this happen to you, where your imagination exceeds your abilities, aside from high school?
Constantly. I totally get where you're coming from. Where the picture in your head is amazing, but there's no way that you can put that down on paper or on pixel. And I don't know what I can offer for advice other than it's normal, it's a part of doing what we do, except I will say this. When you find yourself at that point, you have to have equal parts determination and realism. Determination means you've got to try it. You got to try to get that image that's in your head down there. It's the only way you're going to get closer. You may not do it. You may not even come very close yet, but you've got to try it. And then 50% realism. If you've been spinning your wheels for the last hour and you keep erasing and you keep reaching for a new clean sheet of illustration board, you keep starting a new window or a new layer. If it's been an hour or so and you haven't made progress, at some point, you've got to be realistic and start strategizing a different way to approach this page. It's not a failure. It's just a not yet. It might give you some ideas of where you might need to do some practice when you get a chance. You know, maybe architectural renderings and stuff like that is something you need to practice on to bring your abilities up. But in the initial point, don't shy away. And because I know from my own experience, a lot of times I shied away. I'm like, well, I know I'm not going to be able to do that. And of course, in the words of Wayne Gretzky, you miss 100% of the shots that you don't take. So put yourself to the test, give it a shot, but also be realistic. And if you aren't making headway, get the heck out and find another way to do it. Don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, would you say that one of the ways to train yourself to become a better artist is mm-hmm. not only to try it, to take the shot, right? So knowing that you're highly likely to miss, but also I think one of the skill sets that we can all develop, ourselves included, is when your imagination envisions this beautiful scene mm-hmm. and you know that you can't draw it as you imagine it, think about editorially what you can tinker with around the edges that you can draw.
Yes.
And so stretch yourself on this or that aspect of the drawing, but then fall back and be like, well, I mean, I could draw 200 palm fronds, Brad, back there. Or I could just have one very heavily foregrounded palm frond that I draw perfectly well. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
there's cheats that you can do, some of which will ruin the drawing. Absolutely. But as you get better at this, you'll find editorial workarounds where, oh, dang it, Brad, your imagination is definitely exceeding your abilities. But maybe I can get 70% of the way there. Maybe I can get 80% of the way there. Yeah. And maybe that's okay as I get better and better over the years. That's really the only way I have found to do it, because I'll have this image in my head that is gorgeous, is beautiful, is exactly what I want to hit. And then I go to draw it and it's you know, Ziggy at a pharmacist counter all of a sudden.
Hello, do you have my preparation cream?
Yes, I'm drawing a submarine in a mega city underwater. What was the sound you made to end every joke for a Ziggy?
It was the sound that Jack Lemmon made in Odd Couple to clear his eardrums.
So that's the best description of my splash pages.
Here's your
splash page.
But don't back away. Don't back away, but be realistic too.
Yeah, and I think the good news/bad news is that no matter what level you are, I think this is a truism even for people in their 70s and 80s who've been drawing for 50 years, you know?
Yeah. Well, listen, it's got to be a truism. Listen, if the point at which it stops being a truism is the point at which you've stopped growing as an artist.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, on some level,
did I catch you off guard there, Dave?
No, I'm agreeing with you. The truism is this, is that, also the challenge is what makes it fun. If everything was an easy serving of, you know, soft serve rice and mashed potatoes, then eating would stop being fun. Like, cause you want the new, the variety, the spice, the trickiness of preparing a new dish. You know, I don't know where I'm going with that, but anyway,
I'm still trying to get over soft serve rice.
I was going to go down a metaphorical path and I bailed out really quick. What I was getting at is, you know how they serve old people like the same plain foods because nothing can upset their tummy, right?
Yeah.
And you don't want your artwork to, your art challenges to become like that, where here's another soft serving of mashed potatoes and rice on your tummy. You want it to be like, here's a tricky thing to try to tackle and see if you can do it, because that's fun. That's fun to do.
Yeah. And you know, what also happens when you're challenging yourself to do that, just to bring this to a close, is sometimes necessity is the mother of invention. And every now and again, when you're trying to solve that problem, and really illustration is all about solving problems, when you're trying to solve that problem, you'll come up with either a technique or a tool or some kind of something that allows you, if not to do that image that was in your head, at least to come really close.
Yeah. Well, okay, so here is a, since we kind of put that one to bed, here is a somewhat related question from James Anderson. It's about working digitally. Can I read this one to you, Brad?
Go right ahead.
Dave and Brad, when working digitally, how do you keep from zooming way too close in and adding way too much detail that either won't be seen or muddies up the frame and doesn't match the other frames around it? In my house, we call that getting the zoomies. So, Brad, how do you avoid zooming in too much, too frequently, drawing with too much detail at a level that, frankly, won't reproduce either on a digital presentation on the web or in a print presentation on a book?
Wait, before we do that, can we just address how precious this household must be? They've come up with a name for this, and they say around the house, getting the zoomies. What's the matter, hon? Oh, I've got the zoomies again. Oh, I thought we were past this. I mean, do they have other phrases for other things that happen? This sounds like kind of a fun house to be in.
I thought getting the zoomies was like, oh boy, I should not have had that burrito. Oh no. Oh, I got a case of the zoomies. Oh no.
Where's dad? Oh, he's in the Johnny. He's got a case of the zoomies.
He's got a case of the zoomies. Oh man, we got to get dad some more soft serve rice. See, I brought it around, Brad.
Look
I brought
at what
it
you
around.
Did there. Well, listen, if we're actually going to answer this question, I've got a suggestion, but it's a Clip Studio Paint suggestion, because I, of course, draw in Clip Studio Paint like a champ. And in Clip Studio Paint, if you go to Window and you pull down to, now that I've done it, oh yes, if you pull down to canvas and over to new window, you can actually show your one illustration in two different windows. And so what I like to do is I keep one window up in the upper right-hand corner and I'm zoomed out so I can see the big picture. And then I can zoom in on my main window and I can do a little bit of detail work or I can get as close as I feel I need to. But I can always glance up with one of my eyes, chameleon-like, because I can make my eyes move independently. I can glance up with one of my eyes and check out how that's looking in the big picture. And believe me, it becomes very, very apparent very, very quickly. If you're just muddying up the image by drawing every individual leaf of grass, you can kind of keep track for yourself how this is affecting the big picture. So I would go up to window, come over to new canvas, and have a big picture view floating there on your monitor.
Well, I know Photoshop has the same kind of trick where you can have a full-size or semi-full-size second window popped up. Mm-hmm. I don't remember how to do it offhand. I'm so sorry that I don't. But that trick does exist. But here's my alternate option, which is I have just gotten into the habit with Drive of constantly zooming in and zooming out. And yeah. For me, it is just a habit that I come to appreciate. Like, all right, I'm drawing the nose very close in. Now I'm going to zoom back out. Ah, yeah, that looks right. Now I got to fix a little bit zooming back in. And to me, that's the equivalent of like my physical nose very close to the drawing board versus me like holding it up at arm's length to see how it looks holistically, you know?
Yeah.
It's not the greatest, but here's the thing that I want to talk about my own failures with this. When I first started drawing digitally, I zoomed in so much to the point that like I was drawing like a map that someone was holding in the background of a frame. And I was doing details on the map.
Yeah.
And then I zoomed back out again and it was literally, Brad, a smudge. And I had spent like 10 minutes on this map.
You've got the north arrow. You've got the mile to inch conversion. You've got the grid. And meanwhile, it's a square centimeter on the page.
Yeah, it literally ends up being 3 pixels. And so part of it is we all just have to cut our teeth doing it. And like, you have to make a couple mistakes. And it's usually within 2 or 3 pages of doing that. You go, oh, I see what the scale is here.
Yeah.
A lot of people I know try to draw at 100% all the time so that they avoid that mistake, but that's not fun. One of the advantages and joys of digital drawing is being able to zoom in, being able to spin the canvas, being able to turn it upside down, being able to flip it, all those sort of tricks that like you wish you could do on paper.
Yes.
And so I take advantage of zooming in. And it, frankly, the way you learn is you just have to make the mistake over 4 or 5 pages, I think, at worst case. And you'll eventually get a sense of scale. Like, oh, if I'm drawing this, then all right, that's I don't want to go any further in than that. Brad, what do you think?
Oh, I think it's a case of getting burned a few times and learning not to burn yourself anymore. And also, like Dave said, you start to recognize it. In other words, when I'm drawing, my line on the screen looks very line-like. But when I'm zoomed way in, I can actually start to see the pixels. Well, when I'm starting to see pixels when I'm drawing, I know I'm too close. And this stuff that I'm drawing, I should probably back up a little bit and take a little
easy. Oh, you know what? That's
easy.
Even better shorthand, Brad, than I would have suggested.
Yeah,
so yeah, that's
yeah.
probably as good or better than anything I was going to say. So that's a good spot to leave that one there. Brad, good job closing out the zoomies there.
Well, thank you very much. In that case, I've got a question for you.
All right.
This comes in from our Patreon backer, Francis Foster, who says, I have a number of people around me, young and old, with budding artistic talent and or interesting stories to tell. How do I exhort them to try their hand at comics? Dave, you are one of the best exhorter that I've known in many years. I give Francis some advice here.
Well, so there's a couple different ways of reading this, and I'm not sure which way to read it. One of it is they are budding talents that are writing and artistic budding talents, but maybe they don't particularly know or like comics. And so if that's the case, I'm a little bit anxious because you don't want to force someone into comics and be like, no, you're going to draw comics. But maybe what Francis is saying is that they haven't yet been exposed to comics and what are the best ways to do it. And frankly, a 5-minute talk with any librarian, local librarian, will give you the age-appropriate comics or graphic novels. Like if they are a boy, 4 to 9, then Dog Man, oh boys, they're gonna love that. If they are a girl, 9 to 16, they're gonna love Raina's work. She's amazing. And by the way, it's not even gender specific. You can have I have girls that love Dog Man. I have boys mm-hmm. that love Raina's work. So it's more age appropriate. But what I'm getting at is, if they spark on it, it's almost like you can't stop them from doing comics.
Right.
But I don't want anyone to ever force someone. But by all means, expose them to comics.
Sure.
At least for me, I found that once I knew that Garfield existed, I was like, I want to draw this. This yes. is what I want to do all the time, and you couldn't stop me from doing it. But the best thing to do, as this is true, which is parenting style, the best way to do it is just to expose them to a lot. Let them try a lot of different yep. sports. Let them try a lot of different activities. And whatever they spark to, you're like, all right, great. We'll keep doing that one. So, Brad, what are your thoughts? You're also a dad here. What do you think?
You've said it so much. I'm going to say basically everything you said, but you would have said it much, much more nicer. There's another part of this too, and that is it's none of your business what they do with their art. You know, you can say, hey, you know what, that'd make a good comic. But listen, these people know comics exist.
If they're really young, they might not. That's the thing. I think that's
super,
what...
super. He says young and old. So okay. So maybe if they're super young, they don't know what a comic is. Maybe, your heart's in the right place by saying to somebody, oh, you know what, you'd be really good at doing a comic. Have you ever thought of that? You really ought to think of it. Blah blah blah. But beyond that, their art is not your responsibility. You know, you can suggest, because I could come up to you, Dave, and say, you know what, Dave, I think you really ought to take up cooking. You would be an excellent chef.
Thank you.
And I'm going to send you a book on how to cook, and I'm going to send you a ladle. You're going to love this ladle.
Oh,
and that, but
Brad.
Now you're not supposed to like this. You're going to say, no, I want to do comics.
Oh, wait, no. You know why? You know why I'm liking this? It's because why? You're doing a kindness, Brad, and I'm okay with that.
No, but if I got two, but I got to draw the line. No, if I start sending you ladles and spatulas and how to cook books, at some point I'm going past a line. It's a kindness to say, to encourage you, Dave, I think you'd be a great chef. That's where your responsibility ends.
Yeah. Well, yes. So I'm reading from Francis's question that it's more of the how do I best introduce them to comics as a possibility, and then what yeah. are some good resources to do, right? But I think you and I and Francis would all agree you don't ever like drive it home that they've got to be a chef, right. They've got to be comics, right. Whatever it is. But like, for example, my father was before he retired, was a great surgeon, and was one of his best things about being a surgeon was he was really good at reconstructing accident victims' faces and burns victim faces. He was really good at rebuilding a human face. Mm-hmm. And so I always thought in my 20s, I got to get my dad into a sculpting class. He would be amazing at sculpting live figures and all that sort of stuff. Like, he'd yeah. be great. And something about it just didn't spark with my dad. He was like, I do that for work. I don't want to come home and sculpt more faces. And I kind of get that, you know, like leave yeah. it at the office kind of a thing. But right. But in my heart of hearts, I thought, oh, I'm doing my dad such a solid by reminding him that there is clay. It exists in the world. And he could go to a class and pay $500 and sculpt that clay.
Maybe dad didn't know about clay.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm going to tell dad about clay.
Dad, do you remember that art exists? He's like, what are you doing? No, but with all the best intentions, though, you yeah. can, over the course of your life, try to spark 10 people on art, because one of them might take it up, yeah. you know, and wouldn't that be lovely?
And then if they do express an interest, okay, now let's put a little twist on this, Dave. You've said, okay, you say to this person, you know what, you really ought to think about doing a comic. And then you let it go. And next week they come back and they say, you know what? You mentioned a comic to me, and I'm intrigued by that. Now, let's say we've gotten past the threshold.
Yes, yes, yes.
Now,
yes.
What's the next step? How do you recommend this? What's your best step in, again, knowing your boundaries, but how do you make best use of that window of opportunity now that it has been opened?
So if they're adults, I tend to direct them towards one or three books. Scott McCloud's Making Comics, How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way or How to Draw Comics the DC Way, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Or there's a few other lesser books that I might direct them to that I'm looking on my shelf. I don't see them right now, but it's like I remember there was Drawing Words and Writing Pictures. That's a good one. Mm-hmm. Things like that. There's books that you can direct them to. And then there's also the older for kids. I remember like Randy Glassberg and I think had a cartooning book once. There's a couple of somebody that had a G. Do you remember the author that had a G name that was for kids?
Oh, golly. Well, I remember Chris Hart did he's made a whole industry out of drawing books.
Yeah. But anyway, so I try to direct them towards their library, free books, free resources. You don't have to spend any money. And mm-hmm. then just start drawing. Like, here's some basic materials that I would suggest. A pencil will get you, will do you just fine for the first decade. A basic pen will do you just fine. Nothing fancy. And just start drawing. And I don't know that I would recommend classes for most people. I don't know that a lot of people have responded well when I've said, go take a cartooning class. Because usually, why are you laughing
Dave
at that?
Because my response would be, great, Dave just gave me homework.
You know? Yeah, I mean, the thing that I would recommend for most people in the adults anyway, in the social media age, is just start posting and sharing. Even if it's a second account that's not you, like if it's not the Brad Geiger account, it's Brad's art account, you know, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Just to get you in the habit of posting and sharing a drawing, even if no one is following it, it'll make you accountable to yourself. And then to draw every day.
I kind of disagree.
Okay, yeah, no, disagree with me. I'm willing to be wrong.
You said about three things, and number two and number three, especially draw every day, were right on. But I don't know that my go-to, if I've got that window of opportunity, is going to be a how-to book. In other words, you went to a whole series of how-to books. I think at that point, it's not so much about instruction as it's about inspiration. In other words, they've got a spark, and that spark needs to be nurtured into a flame before it can take form of a fire. You know, it's like Boy Scouts. You know, you build that that little teepee out of wood. You got a spark. Now it's not about instruction. It's about inspiration. And that's when you use your knowledge of comics as a fan and as a practitioner to say, what comic would be best for this person? And the answer is going to be different for any number of different people. You've got to know the person and you've got to know a little bit about comics. But that's when you might say, oh, you know what? I got this Reyna book for you. I checked it out of the library, or it's out of my personal stash. I want you to take a look at that and tell me what you think. Or for another person, it might be, here's The Watchmen. Read that. Tell me what you think. And then offer to discuss it later, you know. I really do think that at this stage, it's more about inspiration and picking. And then you get the real joy of somebody who's got a deep abiding love of comics to say, okay, now I'm going to take some time with this. What's the one book that would really, really touch this off and build that spark into a flame? And that's a joyful thing. You know, you can take some time with that. Every now and again, one of my sons will say, oh yeah, one of my friend's interested in comics. And I'm like, okay, tell me about her. You know, tell me what she likes. We'll think of a good book to send her way to really get her hooked, you know, and then that turns into a whole discussion. You know, what type of person is she? What does she like? How does she draw? What's liable to catch fire with her? And that's a joyful conversation. And then every now and again, you see it happen where somebody's like, oh, wow, I never knew this existed. You know, I never knew this type of thing was even being done. And that's fun. That's when you've picked your moment and respected your boundaries. And then at that point, again, it's about backing off. And letting them build, because it can't be about you. It's got to be about them. And to say, and I've said it 100 times, listen, if you ever want to talk about this, or if you got a question, my door is always open. Give me a holler. But I'm not going to track you down. It's got to be you. It's got to be about you. It can't be about me. And then go back to doing comics. with a little smile on your face that you put some joy into the world, right?
I think that you, I'm going to defer to you on this one because I think you have the better answer. I think you do want to encourage that spark when it arrives. And yeah. I think
you're not wrong. You were just jumping the gun a little bit.
Yeah, that's why I think you're right that, like, obviously, yes, tell them about basic paper materials, that kind of stuff, if they want it. You can give them how-tos. But frankly, passing an 11-year-old boy saying, here, look, read Smile. You're going to love this book. It's perfect for your age group.
Yeah.
Or passing a, I don't know, what age do people read Watchmen? 16? 16-year-old Watchmen.
16, yes.
Yeah. And like you spark them at 16 with like a really good book, or you say like, hey, 9-year-old, here's Calvin and Hobbes, read that, you know, and then you're right. You want to encourage them about how fun and wonderful and unique comics are first. And so, I'm going to a little bit backtrack and say, Francis, I think that's how you do it. I think Brad's right. You encourage them, you really spark them with the best of the best of comics. In the same way that we probably got sparked, and then you follow up as they want to be followed up with, you know, with either resources or suggestions and the like. Brad, what do you think? Is that a good way to summarize that one?
I think it's probably how it happened for you. Look back over your life. Wasn't there somebody that pulled you aside and probably put the newspaper comics in front of you and said, hey, take a look at this. What do you think? I know it happened with me.
I genuinely know of 3 or 4 times in my young life where someone said, David, you really seem to like comics. Here are more comics. And I would go, oh. Like, I remember, and I'm still appreciative of my older brother who didn't read comics, who said, hi, you like comics, huh? I've seen a lot of these Pogo books. I'm going to pass you these. I got these out at the library for you. I didn't know what Pogo was.
Yeah.
It didn't really spark with me story-wise, but the art, I was like, oh, this is very different. And I remember my grandparents setting aside Sunday comics for me and until I went to go visit them. That was important. So yes, Brad, to answer your question, I think, Francis, listen to Brad. Don't listen to me. I am but a poor man's Brad Geiger.
Well, thank goodness you've got a Brad Geiger around to do things like that and to say this. You've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been the true Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And the poor man's Brad Geiger, Dave Callett, my friend and the co-director of Stripped and the cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
I'm so glad that you did say it because I was setting you up to say the poor man's Dave Brad Geiger, and you did it. And that made me, there was a quiet little smile on my end as you did it.
This show is just all like a volleyball game, just bump and spike, bump and spike.
And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode and all episodes was edited by the fantastic Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media. And this show and all the rest of the shows for 2019, sponsored by the good folks of Wacom over at WACOM.com, Wacom.com.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support on Patreon.com/Comic Lab, so we'll go ahead and say that twice. Patreon.com/Comic Lab. I have put my co-host to sleep once again. This is very sad. Every now and again, I just start talking and I realize
that for God's sake, I had myself muted. All right, I'm starting over again. Hold on. Here we go.